Hello and welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message given on Sunday, August 5th, 2012 by Tom Job, answering the question, how can you know what will happen when you die?
Guys, I wanted to read to you all out of this is a letter written from prison. The letter of the Apostle Paul to the Philippians. We've been talking about, like, for the last few weeks, how do you know certain things? Like, how do I know the Bible's true? How do I know that Jesus is who he says he is? How do I know there's only one way to God? How do I know whether or not I'm his? And this week I wanted to just talk about, how do I know, if I love Jesus, how do I know what happens to me when I'm dead? What happens to people who love Jesus when they die? And Paul says in verse 12, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers have become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, and they're so much more bold in speaking the word without fear. Some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel, but the former proclaim Christ out of rivalry and not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. But what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. And I will rejoice, because I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And if I am to live in the flesh, it means fruitful labor. And I don't know which I should really choose. I'm hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, because that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary for your account. Father, help us to understand this. And you know, I do ask if there's anybody here that's afraid, that they wouldn't be afraid anymore. And if there's anybody here who hasn't thought about this, about this week, anybody in here who loves Jesus and hasn't thought about what the humongously vast percentage of their life is going to actually be. I'm glad we're talking about this. So help us to understand things that we really are beyond our understanding. In Jesus' name, amen. In 1741, in this little town in Connecticut called Enfield, in January the 8th, there was a visiting pastor in this church, and his name was Jonathan Edwards. And Jonathan Edwards was probably the biggest brain that has ever been a pastor in the United States. I mean, he was kind of an Oak Ridge-y. Yeah, I mean, you know, like those old, you know, those older Oak Ridge scientists that were so smart, and but they didn't know how to, you know, fill up their gas tank. You know, they couldn't figure out the thing, but, you know, they were like so smart. One time, Potsy and I were driving down Outer Drive, and there was one of the older scientists of Oak Ridge, you know, and you know this guy was like a complete mega genius, and he was watering a bush. Do you remember this? He was watering an azalea bush, and he was standing in the middle of the street with his hose watering this azalea bush, and we drive up to him, and we stop, and he stops, and he looks at us, and looks at his hose, looks at us, looks at his hose, and then, oh, you know, it's just like, wow, dude, you're like right in the middle of the street. I remember Albert Einstein one time, they said he was taking a train in New Jersey, from New Jersey to Massachusetts, and And the controller guy came to check the train tickets, and he couldn't find his ticket. And he kind of went into a panic. And the guy said, "Don't worry, Dr. Einstein. He said, "I recognize who you are." He said, "I know, but I forgot where I'm going." Jonathan Edwards was kind of a guy like that. Like, he was so smart. But he used to go out every day and ride his horse. As he would think of thoughts, he would write them on a piece of paper and he would pin them to his clothes. And they said when he came back, he looked like he had been in a snowstorm. You know, but he was just a super brain, a super sweet person, but a super brain. And he used to write out his sermons on paper and just stand there and read them in this kind of voice, you know, just quiet, studious voice of his. And on this particular occasion, he was just reading out a sermon that he had written about the judgment of God and that people who didn't know Jesus need to think about what's going to happen to them. It was called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. There was really, everything in it was really right straight out of the scriptures. All the images about there's a slippery slope and you don't know when you might slip and you can't stop slipping and all of that. And people started screaming. Like they went into hysterics. And he had to stop like about three times and ask them, "Will you please be quiet? I'm trying to finish this sermon," you know? And they said they felt like the floor was opening and that they were going to go down. And it says, "You have an extraordinary opportunity, a day that Christ has thrown the door of mercy wide open and stands calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners, a day where many are flocking into the kingdom of God from the east, west, north, and south, because he has filled their hearts with love to him who has loved them and washed them from their sins in his blood." And I mean, people were like, "Stop, stop," and just totally screaming. I think it might have been a time when people were more afraid of dying than they are now. And I don't know whether it's because they were more aware of it. You know, just like death was such a constant thing. You know, you think if you lived, I mean, that was kind of like out in the far prairie, you know, Western Connecticut. You figure if you lived in like the little house on the prairie and you get an appendicitis attack, you know, you're done. I mean, or, you know, an abscess tooth or something. And I mean, people died of like all kinds of stuff. And it was just really on their mind a whole lot more. There was at Cades Cove, I remember reading in a book when somebody died, the church bell would begin to ring, then it would stop, and then it would ring the number of the years of the person, and everybody would know who it was. You know, oh yeah, he had like a stuffed up nose, probably dead. And then all the men would go to the mill and they would make a coffin together and the women would go and dress the body. I mean, it was just a part of their day. It was much more kind of present to them, I guess. But I remember, and it's something that people thought about maybe more than they do. But I remember one time when I was at UT in an English class. It was kind of an English-American history class together. And the professor read this sermon. And as he read it, people started snickering and kind of laughing. And more people were laughing. And by the time he got, you know, about halfway through, people were dying laughing. They just thought it was the most ridiculous thing ever that a person could think about the judgment of God at death for people who don't know Christ. I think that it's probably one of the great victories of our enemy, he who shall not be named, but that people would laugh at what happens to people who don't know Jesus when they die. And it's probably one of the great victories that people who do know Jesus would yawn about what happens to them. Because a lot of times when people think about heaven and the images of heaven, it's so dumb. I mean, it's so, you know, boring. Like they think about it being like puffy clouds. I mean, the only time I'm ever like really in really puffy clouds It's after I'm flying home from somewhere, and you're doing that thing from Pittsburgh to McGee to Ice, and it's the end of the day, and there's puffy clouds, and you're almost home. But that's not home. Like, puffy clouds is almost home. But if you had to, like, stay there and, like, harp music, you know, people have, heaven is harp music. I don't know. Harp music is the worst, man. I remember one time I was in Chick-fil-A and not out of Kingston Pike, and they had this guy playing the harp. Really? Chick-fil-A? Guy playing the harp? And people were falling asleep into their food, you know, while he was playing. And so boring. In Europe, they always have babies. Heaven is always flying babies. Flying, like angels to them, are little babies. Flying, undiapered babies. Awesome. Welcome to heaven. Here's your umbrella, you know. But it's just... But I think that probably what a person believes about heaven and what a person thinks about heaven may be the most determinative factor in their personal happiness and their emotional health than any other thing in their life. Like, what they think about heaven and what it is changes a person more than any other thing and more than you actually even understand. Like Paul in Philippians chapter 1, he was in prison for the third time. He'd been in jail one time. It wasn't even really overnight. And he had been in prison another time in Lebanon for a couple of years. And this time he was in prison in Rome. And he was a missionary. And you would think, because missionaries are like super kind of type A. I don't know if you've ever known many, but they're usually really, really driven. And they kind of have to be to live the life they do, because it can be hard and you have a lot of criticism and stuff. I remember when we were in Italy and we used to do a lot of street preaching, and people used to say, oh, don't listen to them. They are those people from Genova. And I was like, Genova is Genoa, the city of Genoa, where Christopher Columbus came from. And I was like, Genoa? What do you mean? And then I realized what they mean is we were testimony to Jehovah. They said, don't listen to them. They're Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm like, whatever. Do I look like that? I mean, good. Yeah, I came over here to, you know, save your sorry self. And you say I'm a Jehovah's Witness. And just, you know, it's a really hard thing. So you have to be kind of hard-headed and driven to be one. And you would think about a missionary in prison. And when he's writing the letter to the Philippians, which are people that he was really close to, and you could just kind of imagine Paul, I would have imagined him writing, I am in prison. Guys, pray for me. This is the worst. God, why have you put me here? And that's not what he said at all. Like, the letter to the Philippians is the most joyful letter of all of Paul's letters. He uses the word rejoice or joy 7 times. And he's like, I'm in prison, guys, and I want you to know it's totally awesome here because God is doing amazing things. The fact that I'm in prison, willing to be in prison for Jesus, it's encouraging people to be bolder about the message. And other people who don't really like me that much, they think by talking about Jesus to everybody, it can kind of get my goat, which it doesn't. I'm just glad, man, because God is using me, because all I care about is being used by God. And whether I keep on living, even living in this prison, or if I die, that would be a ton better, because the moment you die, like, what if I could die for Jesus? That would be so awesome, because people would go, man, he was willing to really, you know, give everything for this. And he said, and the moment you die, he says in another place, when you're absent from the body, you're at home with the Lord. A person who believes in Jesus, the moment you die, you depart to be with Christ. And he said, that's far better. He uses a word that means it's much, much, very, and the word is stronger. That's a stronger thing, to just depart and be with Jesus. The word depart is a word that means to untie something, like a helium balloon, or, you know, and you just untie it, and it just goes away. I remember when, Lee remembers this too, when we went to Chicago one time, And we were with the bridge trip, and we were at this place called the Navy Pier, and there was this magician named Misner. And he was terrible. I mean, he was doing like a magic show for kids. He was terrible. I mean, he was like the worst magician. And he was telling these jokes, and they were totally bombing. And then he was going to take the birds out of his hand, out of his, you know, birds out of nowhere. But he did the flower thing. And what he did, this little blue bag fell in the floor, and it had a bird's head sticking out of it. And I'm like, what? And that's how they do it, is they put those birds in a little bag. I didn't know it. And this bird, they look at each other. He's like, oops. And I'm like, whoa. And he put that bird, you know, all he's waiting for is just to be untied. And he flies away. And that's what Paul said, is when you leave this body, you leave it. And you're with the Lord in that very second. And it says, like, in so many places, in Matthew 25 and so many other places, that heaven is like a party. It's like a wedding party that went on forever and ever and ever. Their weddings did. And this is one that never ends. And there's singing and dancing. Somebody said stars are actually holes in the sky where the party lights are shining through. And it's just, Paul says, in one place, eye has not seen, an ear has not heard, and it's never entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him. In other words, you've never seen anything like it. You've never heard anything like it. You've never imagined it. You couldn't imagine it. It's just that heaven is like when the New Testament talks about heaven, it's compared to how the Old Testament talks about things. And the way in the Old Testament, it tells us that God, our God, is a God of love and a God of mercy. And he shows mercy to endless generations. And it's so good to know. But when you get to the New Testament, he's like, you know what I mean by that? That God is a God of love and mercy? Jesus. And then it's like that's what you mean by love. It's kind of like if all you've ever had is like Kraft Parmesan cheese, and then you go to Italy and you have Parmigiano Reggiano, the real stuff, and you're like, oh man, this is like totally different. You know, that God is a God of love, and a woman who had gynecological bleeding for 12 years, isolated from all of her family, and she's like, if I can just touch his robe, I think something good would happen, and she did. And he knew exactly what happened, exactly who it was. And he stopped and he said, who did that? He knew, but she needed to stand up and say it was me. And she needed a public declaration of her healing so that her family and her friends would accept her back. And he said, my daughter. Shoo. I mean, I don't care if your family hasn't wanted you for 12 years. I want you. I want you in my family. Oh, that's what you mean when you say God is a God of love. Yes. And it says in Psalm 103 that he forgives us. And it's as far as the east is from the west. And Paul said, you know what he means by that? That you're justified. Like, not only are you forgiven for everything you've ever done, do, or will do, but you're as righteous in the sight of God as Jesus. All of his righteousness is yours. And God sees you as righteous as him. That's what the New Testament means by that. And in the Old Testament, they talk about flying away and being gathered to their fathers. And, you know, I'll be satisfied when I see your face. But where you go after you die, it's kind of dark and gloomy and it's all unclear. And then when you get to the New Testament, it's like, it's unimaginably awesome, and it happens the instant. Jesus said, I'm going to prepare a place for you, and when I come again, I'm going to come and get you. And I do believe that happens, that a moment a person dies who loves Jesus, he comes to get you. He comes to get them. And he takes them home, and they're instantly there. And that Paul said, I'm going to depart to go there. That may be the most important concept that you've ever gotten into your mind as far as your personal happiness. Like, how can you be a happy person in this world? Because what that means is heaven is not this. Heaven, you have to depart to go there. Heaven is not here. I don't expect this place to be heavenly. I don't really expect anything in this world to satisfy me. It's not going to. And I don't really expect it to. I don't really expect much out of the world that we live in. And that can make you happier than you have ever been, because you're totally free from disappointment. Because I'm just not expecting all that much out of this world. This is not heaven, and heaven is not here. People who went to heaven, like there are certain people in the scriptures, and they had like an unexpected opportunity to go there, like Ezekiel went there one time, and he talked about it in chapter 1. And it's funny because when he talked about it, he's like, I can't really tell you. I'm going to get as close as I can to tell you what I saw and stuff, but it was kind of like this, and it was kind of like that, and this is as good as I can explain it, because there are not words to explain it. He uses the word like, it was like this and like that 13 times. And John does the same thing when he got to go to heaven unexpectedly in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5. And he said, and I saw the throne, and it was kind of like a carnelian stone. And there was something around the throne that was kind of like a rainbow that was like 360 degrees. And I saw these creatures, and they were kind of like this. This is the best that I can do in describing it. And the Apostle Paul said, the time that he went to heaven, there are not words in our language to tell you what I saw. And you're like, what? The Apostle Paul went to heaven? Yes, he did. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, he said, I don't even know if I was in my body or not, but I saw things that could not be uttered. And I personally believe that it totally changed him. Because it could have happened in Acts chapter 14. He was in the city with his friend Barnabas, and people got really upset because of the message of Jesus or whatever. And so they took him out and they stoned him. And every, you know, like big pile of stones. There's just, all there is stones and people crying. And they thought he was dead. And then all of a sudden, you know, a stone moves, and then he stands up in the middle, and he wasn't dead. But it could have been that was the time that he went to heaven. But, you know, in chapter 9 of the book of Acts, when he just accepted Jesus, like first accepted Jesus, before he accepted Jesus, he was a person who believed that the kingdom of God was coming to this world, which it will, and that's kind of another story. But that his hope was heaven, this world kind of turning into heaven. And the problem was that there were too many people in it. That was messing everything up. So his thing was to arrest them and get them thrown in prison so we can make a heaven out of this place. And then when Jesus appeared to him and he was like, oops, I was really wrong about that. And he realized that Jesus was the Messiah. Then he was just as aggressive and just as assertive of trying to convert everybody. Like, the problem is there's too many sinners. First he tried to kill them, then he tried to convert them. Because if he could get everybody to accept Jesus, then heaven would come to this world. And, you know, I think that, so I'm just trying to get heaven here. And I think that when he got to visit heaven, and he saw things that he couldn't even describe. He saw Jesus on his throne. That, I think that calmed him down. You know, there's one place, and in fact, he says in that part that we read in his letter to the Philippians, he said, you know, this is so awesome. God is really in control, because his whole deal was, I want to go to Rome, and I want to share Jesus with important people. Like, what if I could share Jesus with the Caesar himself? And he wound up in prison, but he was guarded by the Imperial Guard, which was kind of like the Caesar's family special unit, security unit. And they found out about why he was there. And I think some of them accepted Jesus because at the very end of Philippians, he's kind of saying so-and-so says hello to you. And he says, and those of Caesar's household say hello to you. And I think that guards accepted Jesus. And they were up there talking to people in Caesar's family. It's kind of like Carson in Downton Abbey, you know. And it's like, it's one of them's talking about, oh, that crazy guy down there. And he says, your lordship, if you would listen to him and find out about what he's talking about, excuse me, lordship, but it might do you some good. You know, it's just Paul was aware that God was on his throne after he got to go to heaven, but also because he was aware of the fact that heaven is just so much. He says in chapter, much more beyond, in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, he said, heaven is kind of like the body that you have in heaven. It's like the difference between a seed and the plant. Like the body you have now is a seed. The body you'll have in heaven will be like the plant. Like if you think about an acorn, you know, it's just a little acorn wearing his little hat. And you plant it in the ground, and only 1 in 10,000 actually turn into an oak tree. But an oak tree that gets to be 35 feet in circumference, drinking 50 gallons of water a day, 100 feet tall, 135 feet wide, making 5,000 acorns a year. And he said, that's it. That like your body here is just like a little acorn. But the body you're going to have there, it's going to be like the oak tree. I mean, you can't even imagine it. One person said, heaven, it just has dimensions that we can't conceive. That this person said, it's kind of like every time you go to another dimension, it makes things so much more exciting. Like if you have a dots, like a little row of dots, that's kind of like one-dimensional dots. And then one of them moves and it becomes a line in the second dimension. So it has the same thing it had before, but something else. And the other dots are like, what? What? What did you just do, man? That was unbelievable. So then they all learn how to be lines, and then a line moves through space and it becomes a rectangle. What? How did you do that? You know, and then they all learn how to become rectangles, and then it moves through space and it becomes a cube. Oh my word, that is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And it's just like heaven. It's just that it's stuff that it just goes beyond our ability to understand it. And I'll never be satisfied here. Because this isn't that. And all of the disappointments that you feel become kind of longings for something that you've never experienced, but you're longing for it. And if you have disappointments, or even if you have awesome experiences, like, you know, Tina and I, well, I've never been camping before, but we've been camping. I've gone 3 times camping in the Smokies in a tent. And it's really super fun. And we've been having an awesome time. We went to Elkmont. Well, last time we were at Elkmont. And at Elkmont, it used to be a logging community, and then it became kind of people would build summer homes. And then when they turned it into the national park, all these summer homes, they're just letting them fall apart. There used to be a train every day from the L&N station in Knoxville to Elkmont, and people would go to Elkmont, and they would stay in these summer homes. And now they're all just falling apart. And so stupid, but the first time, well, and the second, and the third time, we walk up these woods and you see these old homes. They're just crumbling. And it just made me cry. Just to think about, because you could just squint and imagine the families and the kids playing. And now that it's just gone. And it seems so sad, but even the most beautiful thing, the last time we went, we always said we need to go when the mountain laurels are in bloom. We never did. And why don't we do it? Why don't we do that? And this time we did. The mountain laurels were in bloom, and we hiked to Charlie's Bunyan, and the whole mountainside was mountain laurels and wild azaleas. And it was so beautiful. And there was a place in my heart that was just kind of sad. Because, I don't know why. I don't know what it is. It's just like, yeah, but this isn't the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Because you haven't seen it yet. And this isn't going to compare at all. I remember one person, sometimes people say, oh, sex, man, that's the most awesome thing ever. And it is awesome. It's super fun if you do it God's way and all that. It is. And it's so good for, a married couple and keep them together and all that stuff. But I remember Phil Yancey saying, people just say sex. It's the most awesome thing ever. Like, so awesome. And he said, if you're like on the Chicago subway, statistically, 20% of the people had sex the night before. Look at their faces. Can you even tell? If it's so awesome, wouldn't they be like, yeah, Bobby, it's just like, it's great, but it's not that, just that awesome, there's something in your heart. There was a guy named Malcolm Muggeridge who accepted, he was an atheistic British journalist, and he accepted Jesus when he was 80 years old. And in 10 years, he became the sweetest person ever. And he said, I had a sense, sometimes enormously vivid, that I was a stranger in a strange land, a visitor, not a native, a displaced person, feeling I was surprised to find that it gave me a great sense of satisfaction, almost ecstasy. Days and nights and months would pass. Would that feeling ever return, the loneliness? I strained my ears to hear it like a distant music, my eyes to see it, a very bright light very far away. Has it gone forever? And then it would come back. Awe, the relief. The only ultimate disaster that can befall a person, us, I've come to realize, is to feel ourselves at home on this earth. Because as long as we're aliens, we won't forget, our true homeland. It's so important to know that heaven isn't here. And I don't expect this world to be. And I can be happy. Otherwise, I'd be bitter all the time and disappointed all the time. But another thing that Paul says is to depart and be with Christ. Heaven isn't far. It's not like, you think about that. Scientists believe that if you divide the sky into 26 millionth areas of 20 in a grid, that's 26 million. Every grid would be like a grain of rice. There are galaxies. The Hubble telescope has told us galaxies in that area. And they estimate there are 300 sextillion stars, which is 3 with 23 zeros. And they don't even know. And you think, well, if heaven, like Paul said, I was caught into the third heaven, and it just happened like that. Because first there was the heaven with clouds and birds, and then they believed there was a heaven with the stars, and the third one was beyond that. And you're like, well, if you go up, how far do you have to go? How long is it going to take to get there? And I always wondered, and the Chinese, how did they get to heaven? If I'm going up, they're going the other way. So it's just kind of like, how does all that, but it's not like that. It's like heaven is like Jesus said to the thief on the cross. I heard this woman was researching how they're going to make food for the Mars trip that's going to take 3 months. And how do you make food that's just not gross in 3 months, So if it takes 3 months to get to Mars, how long does it take to get? It's not like that. That heaven, it's outside of time. It's like a curtain. And it's near to us. And Jesus told the thief on the cross, you'll be with me today. It's like you just slip into it and you're in a outside of time and it's like it's near to us. It's kind of like Devo and Aaron went, I remember they went to, when Aaron was expecting Allie Mae, they went to a Braves game. And so Devin and Aaron and Cam went to the Braves game and Allie Mae went to the Braves game. But, before they went, she was just as far away from the game as they were. But then when they were there, she was right in the game. Allie Mae was right in the middle of the game. It was all around her, but she didn't know it. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's heaven. It's all around us. And it's like how Jesus said, I'm going to I'm going away in John chapter 14. I'm going away. And it's good that I'm going away. But in chapter 15, he says, but whatever you ask me in my name, I'll do it for you. I'm going away, but I'm not, I'm here. I'm near. In Acts chapter 1, Jesus went up into heaven in chapter 1, but he calls that book, these are the things that, in my first volume, the Gospel of Luke, it's what Jesus began to do and to teach. And now that he's gone into heaven, he's still doing those things here. He lives in heaven, but he is involved in the life of earth. And that's the way we are. We live on earth, but we're involved in the life of heaven. Because Paul said, in Philippians 1, he said, what I want to do, whether by life or by death, I want Jesus to be exalted in my body. The Greek word exalted is our word magnified. Like when you magnify something, you don't make it bigger. You make something appear to be closer. And he said, and that's what I do. I want people to know that Jesus is close. And I do it by loving him. Because that's what we're going to do in heaven. I do it by praising him. And I do it by loving him. And people look at that and they see, I love someone. And he's in my life. And when I go to die and depart, I'm going to fully do what I do now. But I am on earth to love him. If I could, believing in Jesus is how you get into heaven. Loving him is how you get ready. Because that's what we're going to be doing. We're living on earth, but we're actively involved in the life of heaven, which is love. It's what we're going to do. If you don't like doing it now, get into this, because that's what we're going to be praising him, and we're going to be loving him. And if I could live for one thing, like if for the rest of my life, it would be to try to help people fall in love with Jesus. And if I think he would ask that same thing, he said to people one time, they were doing all this church stuff, and he said in a letter that he wrote, I have one thing against you. You don't love me as much as you should. And he said, and if you don't fall in love with me, I'm going to take your lampstand away. Really, that's the message that you have for the world. I'm not far away, and you love me, and you praise me, and you're getting ready for a time when you'll love me like all the time. Because heaven, it isn't here, but heaven isn't far. And we're living our time in this world to fall in love with him and to praise him. You know what? I just feel like that's kind of the Christian maturity. It starts out, you believe the message. I believe in the message about Jesus. And then you grow and you realize, I believe not only in a message, I believe in someone. And then you grow a little bit more and you think, I live in someone who paid for me. I live in someone who paid for me because he loves me. Wow. Someone paid for me because he loves me. I love him. And I live to love him. Jonathan Edwards, he was fired from his church in 1750. It's kind of like when the owner of the Red Sox traded Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees. It's like, way to go, guys. And he went to share the gospel 50 miles to the west to the Mohicans and the Mohawk Indians. And he used to get choir professors to come out there and teach them how to sing because he wanted them to get ready for heaven. His daughter married Aaron Burr Sr., who was the president of Princeton, and he died. And they asked Jonathan Edwards to become the president of Princeton College, which he did. But they were doing experimental research in smallpox, and he allowed himself to be inoculated with smallpox so that they could learn more about it. And he got a fever, and his throat closed, and he couldn't even drink. And in a couple of weeks, he was dead. And he wrote to his daughter and said, Dear Lucy, it seems to me to be the will of God that I must shortly leave you. And therefore, I give you my kindest, please give my kindest love to my dear wife. And tell her that the uncommon union that has long sustained us has been of such a nature that I trust is spiritual and will continue forever. And as to my children, you are now to be left fatherless, which I hope will induce you to seek a father who will never fail you. And he went to a place that he said one time in an amazing sermon called Heaven is a World of Love, that there all shall have as much love as they desire, and as much love as they can bear. And such will be the sweet and perfect harmony among the heavenly saints, perfect love reigning in every heart towards every other without limit or restriction or interruption. Father, I do pray for us. I pray if there's anybody here that has let his or her love for Jesus grow cold, I ask you that they would stop whatever they're doing and devote themselves to loving him, and because it's all you want, and it's all we'll ever do. To see him face to face, how could it be?
For more information about Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, including staff blogs, ministries we love and support, or just to connect with us, you can find us on the web at c3oakridge.org.